and welcome to Herald Extra, the podcast that takes a look behind the scenes of the Presbyterian Herald, the magazine of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. I'm Sarah Harding, the editor of the Herald, and I can't quite believe we're now on to our fifth episode. Last month we talked to Sharon Hastings and Jamie Meeklam as part of a special mental health edition. And today I'm joined in my office by Professor Stephen Williams, Honorary Professor of Theology at Queen's University, and Very Reverend Dr. Norman Hamilton, a former moderator of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. We'll be discussing the March 2020 edition. Welcome to you both.
Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Morning. So Stephen, you've written a fascinating article on artificial intelligence for this edition, and it was very timely in our household because we have just recently purchased an Echo Dot, much to my annoyance because I really do not like the idea of having devices where someone is listening to you all the time. But my husband was very keen to get a music speaker for the kitchen and it was affordable, so he went ahead and got it. And then literally a couple of days later, you sent in your article to my inbox and I read it with horror, thinking this is all my worst fears confirmed. Of course, I was very gracious though. I didn't say to him, I told you so, although I did suggest that he maybe perhaps read your article. But what is the truth in that? Do you think we should be cautious about embracing the use of such devices?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you can tell by that incident that I'm not a prophet, or you'd have heard before you purchased from me. But afterwards. I think so indeed. A book came out last year, this 2019, by Shoshana Zuboff, who is Professor Emerita at Harvard Business School, called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. It's an immensely important book. And Zuboff devastatingly documents the extent to which surveillance is going on with the high-tech companies. It's well known in some quarters, quite apart from what she says, but she brings detail to it. So I do think one has to be careful. As with so many things, Sarah, you know, a range of things go under the title of artificial intelligence, but on this particular one, yes, I am not an expert in this particular area of AI at all, but caution, very much so, I think. We've got to watch what's happening in the world of surveillance.
Yeah. And even just last week, I saw a news article that was talking about stuff in China. And they were saying that the government there, they're heavily using AI to monitor people, using things like facial recognition, collecting vast amounts of data on people, and even using something called predictive policing, which is identifying people for detention or investigation before they've even done anything, which obviously has huge implications for Christians in terms of persecution. Have you been following all of that?
I've followed some of the stuff in China, yes. But you see, a number of years ago, you had one of Barack Obama's advisors remarking that we know how people are going to vote before they've made up their minds themselves.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, you might say that's an exaggeration, a rhetorical, but there's too much truth in it for us not to be worried about it, I think. China, in any case, is massive in terms of robotics and AI. I mean, in other ways, if you notice what's going on there, you know, frequently when companies want a maximally cheap labour, they have factories in countries where labour is cheapest. Some Chinese operations, you'd expect some of them to be taking place, say, in Laos or Myanmar, where labour is cheaper. That's not the case. Why not? You'd think they'd save money. It's because so much is being done by robots.
Okay.
China's a huge market for robotics. So yes, this is part of a wider trend, I think, in China.
Okay. If you had told me a story, I think, before about somebody that you knew going to a conference and they were seated by a robot. Is that right?
Yes. An acquaintance of a friend of mine went to a conference in China and he was being taken to a seat by a woman. He noticed the elegance of her walk. So he was taken to a seat by her, sat down. Only when he looked into her eyes did he see it was a robot.
Yeah, it's frightening.
The eyes, you know, are the
window to the soul.
The hardest, hardest to assimilate, I think. But the elegance of movement is important here because you think of robots as moving in a way which would be more stilted than humans do. But, you know, as often as I share an anecdote like that or hear about the kind of thing you were mentioning in your own home, I realise that these kinds of things are set in circles have been known about for years and years and years and experienced for years and years and years.
Yeah.
You know, we are late getting there. And many high-tech companies know that we are in an unregulated area and they press on with doing certain things because businesses take a long time to catch up sometimes with what's happening. You know, standard businesses take up a long time to catch up with what's happening in high-tech businesses. The law takes a long time, governments take a long time, so on they go before things are regulated.
Yeah, and you say in the article that we must wake up to the fact that we use technologies uncritically most of the time, that we just kind of are going along with it. And you make the link that we do this because essentially it makes our lives more convenient and comfortable. So then as Christians, do we really need to wake up and look at and tackle that overriding desire for comfort that we all have?
Very much so, I think. I was reflecting self-critically, I should say, and I mean that, on Paul's words in 1 Timothy when he talks about contentment, the importance of contentment. And he says, with food and clothing, with these, we will be content. Mm. And I was thinking to myself, actually, we are not.
Yeah.
We do require more than that. So I think that there is a level of prosperity and expectation in much of our society. And therefore, the technology fits in to that. And because it's convenient and quick, we get on with it. But as a matter of fact, it's part of a much wider social and economic scene.
Yeah,
think we have to be very vigilant.
Norman, do you have any echo dots?
Yes, I mean, I agree that we're becoming an increasingly, a society with increasing surveillance. But this goes back a long time. I remember reading 10, 15 years ago, for example, that Tesco, in their loyalty cards, we were able to know that a woman was pregnant before her family would, because of the changes in her buying habits.
Wow.
And recently, my wife and I were in Lancashire, and I noticed on every single lamppost, or in on a stretch of the M6, this would be about every 100 metres, there was a camera. And that was for miles. Now, that is presumably about traffic management, but nonetheless, I was quite struck that every 100 yards from maybe about 5 miles, we were under surveillance.
Yeah.
So surveillance is here. But maybe I should also admit that Santa came to us at Christmas with an Echo Dot as well. In fact, he came with two.
Two, okay.
And what do we use them for? We use them for playing the radio, and they're on all the time. But I do occasionally ask Alexa what the weather is going to be today, okay, and she's always right.
We play Pointless. Well, that's the one thing I like about Alexa. but do you turn it off? I'm very conscious of turning it off at the plug. I don't like to have it on all the time.
Well, Evelyn, my wife Evelyn and I have talked about this, and I think we have come to the view that we are quite happy for the folks, wherever they are in Silicon Valley, to hear every conversation about what we're going to what we're going to Tesco for, or what's on our agenda for today. We do not regard ourselves as being a high security risk either to ourselves or to the state.
Fair enough.
But nonetheless, Stephen's point is an important one, that surveillance undermines relationships. And for me, that is another side of this, that instead of the robotic woman taking you to the seat in the exhibition or convention in China, it would have been much better relationally if you had been greeted by a real person who would have interacted with you on the way between you coming through the door and going to the seat. So that setting aside of the importance of relationships in favour of efficiency does seem to me to be an existential threat to what it means to be human.
Yes, you often would talk in your articles, you are always talking about fellowship and connection and friendships and how we need to, as Christians, really embrace all of those things, and we're kind of moving away from that. One of the things that you mentioned, Stephen, in your article was for older people in Japan that they will now be perhaps looked after by robots. What effect do you think longer term that is going to have on all of us if we move away from that human-to-human contact?
Well, if we become a relationally free zone, then by definition we become more lonely, we become more aggravated, we become more angst-ridden. And you see that in dreadful technicolor in the political world, where our politics is now so adversarial that the whole community is polarized and that Christian people are being dragged into this, into these political tribes that don't want to talk to each other. And that was evident, for example, in the few months prior to the Stormont Executive breaking down, when the First Minister and Deputy First Minister put out this now famous press release saying that they were going to work for the common good, they were on the same page, etc., etc., etc. 2 or 3 months later, the whole thing falls apart. So the relationships weren't there, even though they said that these mattered.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be a little parable of where much of society is. In our families, in society, in our churches, we say that relationships matter, but we're not actually prepared to put either the time or the energy or the care into developing and making them real.
You wrote a very strong piece, Norman, this month, referencing the RHI inquiry and essentially criticising Stormont's handling of the whole affair. You used that phrase, unrighteous culture, to kind of describe the times that we're living in. And what I found interesting in both of your pieces was that you referenced sin as an underlying factor. So, Stephen, when you were talking about where we have to be careful of AI, it's where humans are trying to seize the world on our terms rather than on God's. And then, Norman, you quoted Proverbs saying, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin condemns any people. Are we getting just too complacent about sin in our society?
It seems to me, Sarah, that we have reduced sin to a set of sins that we ought not do. I remember there's an old, I don't remember it, but there's an old Victorian song that says, there are three things I must not do. I must not gamble, smoke, nor chew. And what we have done is we've reduced sin to doing some bad things or things we regard as bad. When actually sin, if we go right back to Genesis, is the fracturing of relationships.
Mm.
So anything that fractures relationships seems to me to be much more significant than chewing a piece of tobacco in Victorian eras. So we have lost a sense, if I may put it like this, and Stephen as a theologian may well pull me up on this, we have lost at the very heart of church, we have and church life, we have lost any sense of sin being the big problem that affects us all in every part of life.
Yeah. What do you think, Stephen?
Well, I'm not going to disagree with that, that's for sure. Yes, I think we do pick on certain issues or certain themes and certain sins, and neglect to look at underlying things. And I'm struck by the fact, if I can return for a moment to the general area of AI, I'm struck by the fact that when you read the early chapters of Genesis, and people think this is antiquated, it's not. There are questions of interpretation that have to be asked around Genesis. So it's highly pertinent, I think. Read the early chapters of Genesis, and there's a description of the accumulation of sinful habits arising from the fracture of relationships between God and between them, between humans. And the reason I mentioned AI in that connection is that although it may seem fanciful to make the connection, the story of the building of Babel is extremely interesting because it's a kind of early technology involved there. And there are two things behind it. I think mostly when I hear people talk about it, I'd be interested in your comment on this, Norman. Mostly when I hear people talk about it, they talk about human pride. They want to build this tower that rises up to the heavens. Yes, that is part of it, but also there's fear there.
Yeah.
They say, let's do this, lest we be dispersed. There's anxiety. And it has been said these are two great drivers of culture, pride and fear, or pride and anxiety. And I think you find this behind some developments, not all developments in AI. AI is a massively extensive thing. You find this, there is both, I think, a pride in achievement and an anxiety about the human body, about what we can do and accomplish, what we want to be, all those things.
Yeah.
But in the end, Babel is a sign not only of relationships that have been fractured, but the sign of something God does in response, which is to further separate the peoples, linguistically in that case.
Yes.
I would agree with that, with Stephen's view of the Tower of Babel, the pride and fear. Pride seems to me to be, for example, one of the drivers of politics.
Okay.
And the response of people who don't like the direction that politics is going is of fear. We're seeing that being worked out in Technicolor in the Brexit debate. I mean, we're recording this on the day on which the UK is leaving the European Union, and already the airwaves and the TV channels and the media are filled on the one hand with some saying this is our day of deliverance, which is about pride, and the other one saying, oh dear, what's going to happen to our economy and our jobs and our prices and so forth. So these two are often the two sides of the same coin. And as Stephen has quite properly pointed out, the result of not allowing each of those to be the driver leads to confusion and separation and more division, which brings us back to our importance of relationships.
Can I ask you this, Norman, though? Has it not always been thus? Is there anything new, as far as you're concerned, on the political scene in this respect? Or is it simply a replay of what has always characterised through all time, as far as we can tell, what happens in the world of politics and power?
I think that's largely true, Stephen. I mean, the history of the world is peppered by wars and division and all sorts of nasties. Why I think it is particularly significant and hitting people so hard at the moment is that there has not been a war since the 1940s. So we're now into a much more polarised and adversarial European situation where we are citizens than we have been for a long time. So this is new to us in this generation, even if it is not new in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think we as Christians and as the church can do on a practical level? How can we hold our politicians to account? What sort of things should we be doing as the church and as individuals?
Well, Sarah, you're in danger of pressing one of my rant buttons because I've done some work on this. So it seems to me that fundamental to being a Christian in any society, certainly any Western democratic society, let's leave it at that, is that Christian people must be thinkers, biblical thinkers, about how they vote. We are assailed every day with the Echo Dot or the media with hundreds of hours of media input. And how long do we spend listening to the sermon on the Sunday morning? We get cross if it goes over 25 minutes. How often do we read a Christian book, one of the ones that Stephen would write? How often do we actually explore the scriptures for ourselves and think, what does this mean for my voting patterns? Mm-hmm. And simply to be sucked in to tribal voting because they want to keep the other lot out simply isn't good enough for God, and it's not good enough for our society. So for me, that is a biggie. We must think biblically and creatively, and if we have to vote in a different way from what we did 20 years ago, good job.
Yeah.
That's number one rant, but I won't go to the other.
Okay.
I agree entirely with Norman, of course, much more, Norman, your field than mine. I'm struck, though, by some words that Dietrich Bonhoeffer spoke, and I find Bonhoeffer one of the most impressive and enduringly important of thinkers and theologians. And Bonhoeffer, of course, who got caught up one way or the other, to what extent exactly is disputable, but caught up one way or the other in the plot to assassinate Hitler. Bonhoeffer reflected a lot on politics and on suffering, remarked somewhere that the willingness of people in the church to suffer will do more if we are combating evil than the acquisition of political power. And I think we have to learn that. It's natural for Christians to want political power, natural for Christians to participate in it, and nothing wrong in that as such. But the characteristic mark of the church, Bonhoeffer says there, is the willingness to suffer. And that, I think, is what we're slow to be willing to believe.
Mm-hmm. I think Stephen's absolutely right in that quotation. One of the things that our Council for Public Affairs here in the Presbyterian Church has twigged to recently is that Coherent Christian witness is now going to be a minority people in our society. And we need to get used to that. Now, I personally welcome that, because the combination of having political influence as church in a secular, with a secular government, is a very uneasy and I think a very unsatisfactory way to do Christian witness. So the fact that God's people are going to be a minority in an increasingly secular and post-truth age seems to me to provide a great opportunity. But whether we are prepared to sacrifice the comfort that Stephen was talking about earlier on in order to embrace the overused word challenge of being minority is another question. And I do think our church, our ministers, our elders, our Bible study group leaders, our youth leaders need to actually face up to this personally and then take God's people into the work situation, into wherever they are, knowing that they are likely to be a minority. And our preaching and our teaching needs to address the reality of being discomforted and the reality of pressure. And our ministers need to understand that personally so that they can preach upon it well.
Well, one of the things you talk, Stephen, about in your article is how we're so easily distracted by things and we're not really taking time to be quiet, to listen to God, to pray to God. And just as you were speaking there, Norman, I was thinking, are we also distracted perhaps in the church with our own kind of struggles, our own debates, rather than, you know, uniting together as one Christian voice? Is that a problem for us?
Yes, I'm in danger of going politically church incorrect at the moment. I absolutely accept unreservedly that the big social issues of same-sex marriage and abortion are immensely important. But there is a lot more in Scripture to talk about than those.
Yeah.
The vulnerability of the vulnerability of the poor. The Brexit debate, how do we relate to people from other countries, the stranger in our midst? What about creation and the comfortable lifestyle of waste and disposability? These are big biblical themes.
Yeah.
And it does seem to me that we have done the gospel a disservice, we have done the Scriptures a disservice, we have done our witness a disservice by only focusing on issues of personal morality, albeit they are very important.
Yeah. Stephen, what do you think?
I'm in entire agreement. I find it strange that, you know, again, to revert to Genesis, as a matter of fact, you have there the description, the short description of humans having responsibility, dominion over creation. And then it goes on to talk about humans created as men.
To steward it rather than consume it.
To steward rather than consume, yes.
Yeah.
And then description of humans as male and female. Now, whatever you think of these different issues, one is to do with the environment, the natural world, one to do with the social world and human relationships. It's as though people take an interest in one or the other. It's as though people interested in the environment don't care about issues of human family, sexuality, those things very much. Then those people who are into family and sexuality and those things don't care very much about the environment. You know, it's a strange thing that we're doing here.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm the same. I ask myself, why this imbalance? There's something about us that is, we lack into integration. We're terribly selective, as a matter of fact, in what we say are the important things.
I think there are maybe two responses to that, Stephen. I think one of them is the complexity of almost every issue, and that we can only cope with a limited number of complex issues. And the second one is that we are so busy living the ordinary things of everyday life that actually, to go back to where we were a few minutes ago, we're not taking the time to think even about anything other than the immediate presenting issue that's troubling us.
I think you're right, Norman. I think there's a daunting complexity and you can be overwhelmed by all the issues. And yet in practice, we are taking up attitudes. So even if I haven't thought through the environment or human sexuality or whatever it is, or abortion, the other one you mentioned, even if I haven't thought those things through and regard them as complex, in practice, I am behaving in such and such a way or abstaining from such and such a thing so that I am actually taking decisions on complex issues at a practical level the whole time.
Without having thought about them maybe as much as
sufficiently,
one
should. Yeah.
So more thinking needs to be done.
Amen to that, Sarah.
We'll leave it there. That wraps up our discussion today, but please do check out the March Herald to read Stephen and Norman's articles in full. In it, you'll also find an article by Pip Florett about PCI's church planting conference in May, and Ruth Bromley shares some helpful hints and tips for ministering to the under five age group. My thanks to both Stephen Williams and Norman Hamilton for joining me today. Remember, if you don't already subscribe to the Herald, you can purchase a single digital copy or a yearly subscription at presbyterianireland.org/Herald. We'd really welcome your feedback as well, so please let us know what you think by tweeting with hashtag Herald Extra or by dropping me an email to herald@presbyterianireland.org. And if you want to make sure you don't miss the next episode, you can subscribe to Herald Extra in your favourite podcast software. I'll be back soon with some more guests to discuss the April 2020 edition. Thanks for listening today, and goodbye.